Hobbes, who first developed this vision of human nature into an explicit theory of society, was well aware of this greed dilemma. It formed the basis of his political philosophy. Even, he argued, if we are all rational enough to understand that it's in our long-term interest to live in peace and security, our short-term interests are often such that killing and plundering are the most obviously profitable courses to take, and all it takes is a few to cast aside their scruples to create utter insecurity and chaos. This was why he felt that markets could only exist under the aegis of an absolutist state, which would force us to keep our promises and respect one another's property. But what happens when we're talking about a market in which it's state debts and state obligations themselves that are being traded? When one can't really speak of a state monopoly on force because one is operating in an international market, where the primary currency is bonds that the state depends on for its very ability to marshal military force. Having made incessant war on all remaining forms of the communism of the poor, even to the point of criminalizing credit, the masters of the new system discovered that they had no obvious justification left to maintain even the communism of the rich, that level of cooperation and solidarity required to keep the economic system running. True, for all its endless strains and periodic breakdowns, the system has held out so far. But, as recent events have dramatically testified, it has never been resolved. Part 4. So, what is capitalism anyway? We're used to seeing modern capitalism, along with modern traditions of democratic government, as emerging only later, with the Age of Revolutions, the Industrial Revolution, the American and French Revolutions, a series of profound breaks at the end of the 18th century that only became fully institutionalized after the end of the Napoleonic Wars. Here, we come face to face with a peculiar paradox. It would seem that almost all elements of financial apparatus that we've come to associate with capitalism, central banks, bond markets, short-selling, brokerage houses, speculative bubbles, securitization, annuities, came into being not only before the science of economics, which is perhaps not too surprising, but also before the rise of factories and wage labor itself. Now this is a genuine challenge to familiar ways of thinking. We like to think of the factories and workshops as the real economy, and the rest as superstructure constructed on top of it. But if this were really so, then how can it be that the superstructure came first? Can the dreams of the system create its body? All this raises the question of what capitalism is to begin with, a question on which there is no consensus at all. The word was originally invented by the socialists, who saw capitalism as that system whereby those who own capital command the labor of those who do not. Proponents, in contrast, tend to see capitalism as the freedom of the marketplace, which allows those with potentially marketable visions to pull resources together to bring those visions into being. Just about everyone agrees, however, that capitalism is a system that demands constant, endless growth. Enterprises have to grow in order to remain viable. The same is true of nations. Just as 5% per annum was widely accepted at the dawn of capitalism as the legitimate commercial rate of interest, that is, the amount that any investor could normally expect her money to be growing by the principle of interest, so is 5% now the annual rate at which any nation's GDP really ought to grow. What was once an impersonal mechanism that compelled people to look at everything around them as a source of profit has come to be considered the only objective measure of the health of the human community itself. Starting from our baseline date of 1700, then, what we see at the dawn of modern capitalism is a gigantic financial apparatus of credit and debt that operates, in practical effect, to pump more and more labor out of just about everyone with whom it comes into contact, and as a result produces an endlessly expanding volume of material goods. It does so not just by moral compulsion, but above all by using moral compulsion to mobilize sheer physical force. At every point, the familiar but peculiarly European entanglement of war and commerce reappears, often in startling new forms. The first stock markets in Holland and Britain were based mainly in trading shares of the East and West India companies, which were both military and trading ventures. For a century, one such private, profit-seeking corporation governed India. The national debts of England, France, and the others were based in money borrowed not to dig canals and erect bridges, but to acquire the gunpowder needed to bombard cities and to construct the camps required for the holding of prisoners and the training of recruits. Almost all the bubbles of the 18th century involved some fantastic scheme to use the proceeds of colonial ventures to pay for European wars. Paper money was debt money, and debt money was war money, and this has always remained the case. Those who financed Europe's endless military conflicts also employed the government's police and prisons to extract ever-increasing productivity from the rest of the population. As everybody knows, the world market system initiated by the Spanish and Portuguese empires first arose in the search for spices. It soon settled into three broad trades, which might be labelled the arms trade, the slave trade, and the drug trade. The last refers mostly to soft drugs, of course, like coffee, tea, and the sugar to put in them, and tobacco, but distilled liquor first appears at this stage of human history as well. And, as we all know, Europeans had no compunctions about aggressively marketing opium in China as a way of finally putting an end to the need to export bullion. The cloth trade only came later, after the East India Company used military force to shut down the more efficient Indian cotton export trade. One need only take a glance at the book that preserves Charles Davenant's 1696 essay on credit and human fellowship.
The political and commercial works of that celebrated writer, Charles Davenant, relating to the trade and revenue of England, the plantation trade, the East India trade, and African trade.
Obedience, love, and fellowship might suffice to govern relations between fellow Englishmen then, but in the colonies it was mainly just obedience. As I've described, the Atlantic slave trade can be imagined as a giant chain of debt obligations, stretching from Bristol to Calabar to the headwaters of the Cross River, where the Aro traders sponsored their secret societies. Just as in the Indian Ocean trade, similar chains connected Utrecht to Cape Town to Jakarta, to the kingdom of Gogil, where Balinese kings arranged their cockfights to lure their own subjects to gamble their freedom away. In either case, the end product was the same, human beings so entirely ripped from their contexts, and hence so thoroughly dehumanized, that they were placed outside the realm of debt entirely. The middlemen in these chains, the various commercial links of the debt chain that connected the stock jobbers in London with the Aro priests in Nigeria, pearl divers in the Aru Islands of eastern Indonesia, Bengali tea plantations or Amazonian rubber tappers, give one the impression of having been sober, calculating, unimaginative men. At either end of the debt chain, the whole enterprise seemed to turn on the ability to manipulate fantasies, and to run a constant peril of slipping into what even contemporary observers considered varieties of phantasmagoric madness. On the one end were the periodic bubbles, propelled in part by rumour and fantasy, and in part by the fact that just about everyone in cities like Paris and London, with any disposable cash, would suddenly become convinced that they would somehow be able to profit from the fact that everyone else was succumbing to rumour and fantasy. Charles Mackay has left us with some immortal descriptions of the first of these, the famous South Sea Bubble of 1710. Actually, the South Sea Company itself, which grew so large at one point that it bought up most of the national debt, was just the anchor for what happened. A giant corporation, its stock constantly ballooning in value that seemed, to put it in contemporary terms, too big to fail. It soon became the model for hundreds of new start-up offerings.
Quote, "Innumerable joint stock companies started up everywhere. They soon received the name Bubbles, the most appropriate imagination could devise. Some of them lasted a week or a fortnight, and were no more heard of, while others could not even live out that span of existence. Every evening produced new schemes, and every morning new projects. The highest of the aristocracy were as eager in this hot pursuit of gain as the most plodding jobber in Cornhill. Unquote.
The author lists as arbitrary examples 86 schemes, ranging from the manufacture of soap or sailcloth, the provision of insurance for horses, to a method to make deal boards out of sawdust. Each issued stock. Each issue would appear, then be scooped up and avidly traded back and forth in taverns, coffee houses, alleys, and haberdasheries across the city. In every case, their price was quickly bid through the ceiling, each new buyer betting effectively that he or she could unload them to some even more gullible sucker before the inevitable collapse. Sometimes people bid on cards and coupons that would allow them no more than the right to bid on other shares later. Thousands grew rich. Thousands more were ruined. Quote,
"The most absurd and preposterous of all, and which shewed, more completely than any other, the utter madness of the people, was one started by an unknown adventurer, entitled A Company for the Carrying On of an Undertaking of Great Advantage, but Nobody Knows What It Is. The man of genius who essayed this bold and successful inroad upon public credulity merely stated in his prospectus that the required capital was 500,000, in 5,000 shares of 1,001 each, deposit 21 per share. Each subscriber, paying his deposit, would be entitled to 1,001 per annum per share. How this immense profit was to be obtained, he would not condescend to inform them at this time, but promised that in a month the full particulars would be duly announced, and call made for the remaining 981 of their subscription. Next morning, at 9 o'clock, this great man opened an office in Cornhill. Crowds beset his door, and when he shut up at 3 o'clock, he found that no less than 1,000 shares had been subscribed for, and the deposits paid. He was philosopher enough to be contented with the venture, and set off that same evening for the Continent. He was never heard of again. Unquote.
If one is to believe Mackay, the entire population of London conceived the simultaneous delusion, not that money could really be manufactured out of nothing, but that other people were foolish enough to believe that it could, and that, by that very fact, they actually could make money out of nothing, after all. Moving to the other side of the debt chain, we find fantasies ranging from the charming to the apocalyptic. In the anthropological literature, there is everything from the beautiful sea wives of Aru pearl divers, who will not yield up the treasures of the ocean unless courted with gifts bought on credit from local Chinese shops, to the secret markets where Bengali landlords purchase ghosts to terrorize insubordinate debt peons, to Tiv flesh debts, a fantasy of human society cannibalizing itself, to finally occasions at which the Tiv nightmare appears to have very nearly become true. One of the most famous and disturbing was the great Putumayo scandal of 1909 to 1911, in which the London reading public was shocked to discover that the agents of a subsidiary of a British rubber company operating in the Peruvian rainforest had created their very own Heart of Darkness, exterminating tens of thousands of Huitoto Indians, who the agents insisted on referring to only as cannibals, in scenes of rape, torture, and mutilation that recalled the very worst of the conquest 400 years earlier. In the debates that followed, the first impulse was to blame everything on a system whereby the Indians were said to have been caught in a debt trap, made completely dependent on the company's store. Quote,
"The root of the whole evil was the so-called patron, or peonage system, a variety of what used to be called, in England, the truck system, by which the employee, forced to buy all his supplies at the employer's store, is kept hopelessly in debt, while by law he is unable to leave his employment until his debt is paid. The peon is thus, as often as not, a de facto slave, and since in the remoter regions of the vast continent there is no effective government, he is wholly at the mercy of his master." Unquote.
The so-called cannibals, who ended up flogged to death, crucified, tied up, and used for target practice, or hacked to pieces with machetes for failure to bring in sufficient quantities of rubber, had, the story went, fallen into the ultimate debt trap. Seduced by the wares of the company's agents, they had ended up bartering away their very lives. A later parliamentary inquiry discovered that the real story was nothing of the sort. The Huitoto had not been tricked into becoming debt peons at all. It was the agents and overseers sent into their region who were, much like the conquistadors, deeply indebted, in their case, to the Peruvian company that had commissioned them, which was ultimately receiving its own credit from London financiers. These agents had certainly arrived with every intention of extending that web of credit to include the Indians, but discovering the Huitoto had no interest in cloth, machetes, and coins that they'd brought to trade with them, they'd finally given up and just started rounding up the Indians and forcing them to accept loans at gunpoint, then tabulating the amount of rubber they owed. Many of the Indians massacred in turn had simply been trying to run away. In reality, then, the Indians had been reduced to slavery. It's just that, by 1907, no one could openly admit this. A legitimate enterprise had to have some moral basis, and the only morality the company knew was debt. When it became clear that the Huitoto rejected the premises, everything went haywire, and the company ended up, like Casimir, caught in a spiral of indignant terror that ultimately threatened to wipe out its very economic basis. It is the secret scandal of capitalism that at no point has it been organized primarily around free labor. The conquest of the Americas began with mass enslavement, then gradually settled into various forms of debt peonage, African slavery, and indentured service, that is, the use of contract labor. Workers who had received cash in advance and were thus bound for 5, 7, or 10-year terms to pay it back. Needless to say, indentured servants were recruited largely from among people who were already debtors. In the 1600s, there were at times almost as many white debtors as African slaves working in southern plantations. White debtors as African slaves were in almost the same situation, since in the beginning plantation societies were working within a European legal tradition that assumed slavery did not exist, so even Africans in the Carolinas were classified as contract laborers. Of course, this changed later when the idea of race was introduced. When African slaves were freed, they were replaced on plantations from Barbados to Mauritius with contract laborers again, though now ones recruited mainly in China or India. Chinese contract laborers built the North American railroad system, and Indian coolies built the South American mines. The peasants of Russia and Poland, who had been free landholders in the Middle Ages, were only made serfs at the dawn of capitalism, when their lords began to sell grain on the new world market to feed the new industrial cities to the west. Colonial regimes in Africa and Southeast Asia regularly demanded forced labor from their conquered subjects, or alternatively, created tax systems designed to force the population into the labor market through debt. British overlords in India, starting with the East India Company but continuing under Her Majesty's government, institutionalized debt peonage as their primary means of creating products for sale abroad. This is a scandal not just because the system occasionally goes haywire, as it did in Putumayo, but because it plays havoc with our most cherished assumptions about what capitalism really is, particularly that, in its basic nature, capitalism has something to do with freedom. For the capitalists, this means the freedom of the marketplace. For most workers, it means free labor. Marxists have questioned whether wage labor is ultimately free in any sense, since someone with nothing to sell but his or her body cannot in any sense be considered a genuinely free agent. But they still tend to assume that free wage labor is the basis of capitalism, and the dominant image in the history of capitalism is the English working man toiling in the factories of the Industrial Revolution, and this image can be traced forward to Silicon Valley with a straight line in between. All those millions of slaves and serfs and coolies and debt peons disappear, or if we must talk of them, we write them off as temporary speed bumps along the road. Like sweatshops, this is assumed to be a stage that industrializing nations had to pass through, just as it still assumed that all those millions of debt peons and contract laborers and sweatshop workers who still exist, often in the same places, will surely live to see their children become regular wage laborers with health insurance and pensions, and their children doctors and lawyers and entrepreneurs. When one looks at the actual history of wage labor, even in countries like England, that picture begins to melt away. In most of medieval Northern Europe, wage labor had been mainly a lifestyle phenomenon. From roughly the age of 12 or 14 to roughly 28 or 30, everyone was expected to be employed as a servant in someone else's household, usually on a yearly contract basis, for which they received room, board, professional training, and usually a wage of some sort, until they accumulated enough resources to marry and set up a household of their own. The first thing that proletarianization came to mean was that millions of young men and women across Europe found themselves effectively stuck in a kind of permanent adolescence. Apprentices and journeymen could never become masters and thus never actually grow up. Eventually, many began to give up and marry early, to the great scandal of the moralists who insisted that the new proletariat was starting families that they could not possibly support. There is, and has always been, a curious affinity between wage labor and slavery. This is not just because it was the slaves on the Caribbean sugar plantations who supplied the quick energy products that powered much of the early wage laborers' work, not just because most of the scientific management techniques applied in factories in the Industrial Revolution can be traced back to those sugar plantations, but also because both the relation between master and slave and between employer and employee are in principle impersonal. Whether you've been sold or whether you're simply rented yourself out, the moment money changes hands, who you are is supposed to be unimportant. All that's important is that you're capable of understanding orders and doing what you're told. Now, this is one reason, perhaps, that in principle there was always a feeling that both the buying of slaves and the hiring of laborers should really not be on credit, but should employ cash. The problem, as I've noted, was that for most of the history of British capitalism, the cash simply didn't exist. Even when the Royal Mint began to produce smaller denomination silver and copper coins, the supply was sporadic and inadequate. Now, this is how the truck system developed to begin with. During the Industrial Revolution, factory owners would often pay their workers with tickets or vouchers good only in local shops, with those whose owners they had some sort of informal arrangement, or, in the more isolated parts of the country, which they owned themselves. Traditional credit relations with one's local shopkeeper clearly took on an entirely new complexion once the shopkeeper was effectively an agent of the boss. Another expedient was to pay workers at least partly in kind, and notice the very richness of the vocabulary for the sorts of things one was assumed to be allowed to appropriate from one's workplace, particularly from the waste, excess, and side products. Cabbage, chips, thrum, sweepings, buggings, gleanings, sweepings, potchings, veils, poke, coltage, knockdowns, tinge. Cabbage, for instance, was the cloth left over from tailoring. Chips, the pieces of board that dock workers had the right to carry off from their workplace, any piece of timber less than 2 foot long. Thrums were taken from the warping bars of looms, and so on. And of course, we've already heard about the payment in one form of cod, or nails. Employers had a financial expedient. Wait for the money to show up, and in the meantime, don't pay anything, leaving their employees to get by only with what they could scrounge from their shop floors, or what their families could finagle in outside employment, receive in charity, preserve in savings pools with friends and families, or, when all else failed, acquire on credit from the loan sharks and pawnbrokers who rapidly came to be seen as the perennial scourge of the working poor. The situation became such that, by the 19th century, any time a fire destroyed a London pawn shop, working-class neighbourhoods would brace for the wave of domestic violence that would inevitably ensue when many a wife was forced to confess that she'd long since secretly hocked her husband's Sunday suit. We are, nowadays, used to associating factories 18 months in arrears for wages with a nation in economic free fall, such as occurred during the collapse of the Soviet Union. But owing to the hard money policies of the British government, who were always concerned above all to ensure that their paper money didn't float away in another speculative bubble, in the early days of industrial capitalism, such a situation was in no way unusual. Even the government was often unable to find the cash to pay its own employees. In 18th century London, the Royal Admiralty was regularly over a year behind in paying the wages of those who laboured at Deptford Docks, one reason that they were willing to tolerate the appropriation of chips, not to mention hemp, canvas, steel bolts and cordage. In fact, as Leinbauer has shown, the situation only really began to take recognisable form around 1800, when the government stabilised its finances, began paying cash wages on schedule, and therefore tried to abolish the practice of what was now relabeled workplace pilfering, which, meeting outraged resistance on the part of the dock workers, was made punishable by whipping and imprisonment. Samuel Bentham, the engineer put in charge of reforming the dockyards, had to turn them into a regular police state in order to be able to institute a regime of pure wage labour, to which purpose he ultimately conceived the notion of building a giant tower in the middle to guarantee constant surveillance, an idea that was later borrowed by his brother Jeremy for the famous Panopticon. Men like Smith and Bentham were idealists, even utopians. To understand the history of capitalism, however, we have to begin by realizing that the picture we have in our heads of workers who dutifully punch the clock at 8 a.m. and receive regular remuneration every Friday, on the basis of a temporary contract that either party is free to break off at any time, began as a utopian vision, was only gradually put into effect, even in England and North America, and has never at any point been the main way of organizing production for the market, ever, anywhere. This is actually why Smith's work is so important. He created the vision of an imaginary world almost entirely free of debt and credit, and therefore free of guilt and sin, a world where men and women were free to simply calculate their interests in full knowledge that everything had been prearranged by God to ensure that it will serve the greater good. Such imaginary constructs are, of course, what scientists refer to as models, and there's nothing intrinsically wrong with them. Actually, I think a fair case can be made that we cannot think without them. The problem with such models, at least it always seems to happen when we model something called the market, is that once created, we have a tendency to treat them as objective realities, or even fall down before them and start worshipping them as gods.
We must obey the dictates of the market.
Karl Marx, who knew quite a bit about the human tendency to fall down and worship our own creations, wrote Das Kapital in an attempt to demonstrate that, even if we do start from the economist's utopian vision, so long as we allow some people to control productive capital, and again leave others with nothing to sell but their brains and bodies, the results will be, in many ways, barely distinguishable from slavery, and the whole system will eventually destroy itself. What everyone seems to forget is the as-if nature of his analysis. Marx was well aware that there were far more bootblacks, prostitutes, butlers, soldiers, peddlers, chimney sweeps, flower girls, street musicians, convicts, nannies, and cab drivers in the London of his day than there were factory workers. He was never suggesting that that's what the world was actually like. Still, if there is anything that the last several hundred years of world history have shown, it's that utopian visions can have a certain appeal. This is as true of Adam Smith's as of those ranged against it. The period from roughly 1825 to 1975 is a brief but determined effort on the part of a large number of very powerful people, with the avid support of many of the least powerful, to try to turn that vision into something like reality. Coins and paper money were finally produced in sufficient quantities that even ordinary people could conduct their daily lives without appeal to tickets, tokens, or credit. Wages started to be paid on time. New sorts of shops, arcades, and galleries appeared, where everyone paid in cash, or alternately, as time went on, by means of impersonal forms of credit like installment plans. As a result, the old puritanical notion that debt was sin and degradation began to take a profound hold on many of those who came to consider themselves the respectable working classes, who often took freedom from the clutches of a pawnbroker and a loan shark as a point of pride, which separated them from drunkards, hustlers, and ditch-diggers,
as surely as the fact that they weren't missing teeth.
Speaking as someone brought up in that sort of working-class family, my brother died at the age of 53, having refused to his dying day to acquire a credit card, I can attest to the degree that, for someone who spent most of their working hours working at someone else's orders, the ability to pull a wallet full of banknotes that are unconditionally one's own can be a compelling form of freedom. It's not surprising that so many of the economists' assumptions, most of those for which I've been taking them to task over the course of this book, have been embraced by the leaders of the historic workers' movements, so much so that they came to shape our visions of what alternatives to capitalism might be like. The problem is not just, as I demonstrated in Chapter 7, that it is rooted in a deeply flawed, even perverse, conception of human freedom. The real problem is that, like all utopian dreams, it's impossible. We could no more have a universal world market than we could have a system in which everyone who wasn't a capitalist was somehow able to become a respectable, regularly paid labourer with access to adequate dental care. A world like that has never existed and never could exist. What's more, the moment that even the prospect that this might happen begins to materialise, the whole system starts to come apart. Part 4. Apocalypse. Let's return, then, finally, to where we began, with Cortez and the Aztec treasure. The reader might have asked herself, what did happen to it? Did Cortez really steal it from his own men? The answer seems to be that by the time the siege was over, there was very little of it left. Cortez seems to have gotten his hands on much of it long before the siege even began. A certain portion he had won by gambling. This story, too, is in Bernal Diaz, and it's strange and puzzling, but also, I suspect, profound. Let me fill in some gaps in our story. After burning his boats, Cortes began to assemble an army of local allies, which was easy to do because the Aztecs were widely hated. Then he began to march on the Aztec capital. Moctezuma, the Aztec emperor, who'd been monitoring the situation closely, concluded that he needed at least to figure out what sort of people he was dealing with, so he invited the entire Spanish force, only a few hundred men, to be his official guests in Tenochtitlan. This eventually led to a series of palace intrigues, during which Cortes's men briefly held the emperor hostage before being forcibly expelled. During the time when Moctezuma was being held captive in his own palace, he and Cortes passed a good deal of their time playing an Aztec game called Totoluk. They played for gold, and Cortes, of course, cheated. At one point, Moctezuma's men brought the matter to the king's attention, but the king just laughed and made a joke of it. Neither was he concerned later when Pedro de Alvado, Cortes's chief lieutenant, began cheating even more flagrantly, demanding gold for each point lost, and when he lost, paying only in worthless pebbles. Why Moctezuma behaved so has remained something of an historical mystery. Diaz took it as a gesture of lordly magnanimity, perhaps even as a way of putting the petty-minded Spaniards in their place. One historian, Inga Kleninden, suggests an alternative interpretation. Aztec games, she notes, tended to have a peculiar feature. There was always a way that, by a freak stroke of luck, one could achieve total victory. This seems to have been true, for instance, of their famous ball games. Observers always wonder, viewing the tiny stone hoops set high above the court, how anyone could ever possibly have managed to score. The answer seems to have been they didn't, at least not that way. Normally the game had nothing to do with the hoop. The game was played between two opposing squads, attired as for battle, knocking the ball back and forth. Quote, "The normal method of scoring was through the slow accumulation of points, but that process could be dramatically preempted to send the ball through one of the rings, a feat given the size of the ball and the ring, presumably rarer than a hole-in-one in golf, gave instant victory, ownership of all the goods wagered, and the right to pillage the cloaks of the onlookers. Unquote. Whoever scored the point won everything, down to the audience's clothing. There were similar rules in board games, such as Cortes and Moctezuma were playing. If, by some freak stroke of luck, one of the dice landed on its edge, the game was over, and the winner took everything. This, Clenindon suggests, must have been what Moctezuma was really waiting for. After all, he was clearly in the middle of extraordinary events. Strange creatures had appeared, apparently from nowhere, with unheard-of powers. Rumours of epidemics, of the destruction of nearby nations, had presumably already reached him. If ever there were a time when some grandiose revelation was due from the gods, then surely this was it. Such an attitude does seem to fit perfectly with the spirit of Aztec culture, gleaned from its literature, which exuded a sense of impending catastrophe, perhaps astrologically determined. Just possibly avoidable, but probably not. Some have suggested that the Aztecs must have somehow been aware that they were a civilization skating on the brink of ecological catastrophe. Others, that the apocalyptic tone is retrospective, since, after all, what we know of Aztec literature is almost entirely gleaned from men and women who did actually experience its complete destruction. Still, there does seem to be a certain frantic quality in certain Aztec practices, the sacrifice of as many as tens of thousands of war prisoners, most notably in the apparent belief that, were the sun not continually fed with human hearts, it would die, and the world with it, that it's hard to explain in any other way. If Clenindon is right, for Moctezuma, he and Cortes were not simply gambling for gold. Gold was trivial. The stakes were the entire universe. Moctezuma was above all a warrior, and all warriors are gamblers, but, unlike Cortes, he was clearly, in every way, a man of honour. As we've also seen, the quintessence of a warrior's honour, which is a greatness that can only come from the destruction and degradation of others, is his willingness to throw himself on a game where he risks that same destruction and degradation himself, and, unlike Cortes, to play graciously and by the rules. When the time came, it meant being willing to stake everything. He did, and, as it turned out, nothing happened. No die landed on its edge. Cortes continued to cheat. The gods sent no revelation, and the universe was eventually destroyed. If there's something to be learned here, and, as I say, I think there is, it is that there may be a deeper, more profound relation between gambling and apocalypse. Capitalism is a system that enshrines the gambler as an essential part of its operation, in a way that no other ever has. Yet, at the same time, capitalism seems to be uniquely incapable of conceiving of its own eternity. Could these two facts be linked? I should be more precise here. It's not entirely true that capitalism is incapable of conceiving of its own eternity. On the one hand, its exponents do feel obliged to present it as eternal, because they insist that it is the only possible viable economic system. One that, as they still sometimes like to say, has existed for 5,000 years and will exist for 5,000 more. On the other hand, it does seem that the moment a significant portion of the population begins to actually believe this, and particularly starts treating credit institutions as if they really will be around forever, everything goes haywire. Note here how it was the most sober, cautious, responsible capitalist regimes, the 17th century Dutch Republic, the 18th century British Commonwealth, the ones most careful about managing their public debt, that saw the most bizarre explosions of speculative frenzy, the tulip manias and South Sea bubbles. Much of this seems to turn on the nature of national deficits and credit money. The national debt is, as politicians have complained practically since these things first appeared, money borrowed from future generations. Still, the effects have always been strangely double-edged. On the one hand, deficit financing is a way of putting even more military power in the hands of princes, generals, and politicians. On the other, it suggests that our government owes something to those it governs. insofar as our money is ultimately an extension of the public debt, then whenever we buy a newspaper or a cup of coffee, or even place a bet on a horse, we're trading in promises, representations of something that the government will give us at some time in the future, even if we don't know exactly what it is. Immanuel Wallerstein likes to point out that the French Revolution introduced several profoundly new ideas in politics, ideas which, 50 years before the Revolution, the vast majority of educated Europeans would have written off as crazy, but which, 50 years afterward, just about anyone felt they had to at least pretend they thought were true. The first is that social change is inevitable and desirable, that the natural direction of history is for civilization to gradually improve. The second is that the appropriate agent to manage such change is the government. The third is that the government gains its legitimacy from an entity called the people. It's easy to see how the very idea of a national debt, a promise of continual future improvement, at the very least 5% annual improvement, made by the government to the people, might itself have played a role in inspiring such a revolutionary new perspective. Yet, at the same time, when one looks at what men like Mirabeau, Voltaire, Diderot, Sieyès, the philosophers who first proposed the notion of what we now call civilization, were actually arguing about in the years immediately leading up to the revolution, it was even more about the danger of apocalyptic catastrophe, of the prospect of civilization as they knew it being destroyed by default and economic collapse. Part of the problem was the obvious one. The national debt is, first, born of war. Second, it's not owed to all the people equally, but above all to capitalists, and in France at that time, capitalist meant specifically those who hold pieces of the national debt. The more democratically inclined felt that the entire situation was opprobrious.
The modern theory of the perpetuation of debt, Thomas Jefferson wrote around this same time, has drenched the earth with blood and crushed its inhabitants under burdens ever accumulating.
Most Enlightenment thinkers feared that it promised even worse. Intrinsic to the new modern notion of impersonal debt, after all, was the possibility of bankruptcy. Bankruptcy at that time was indeed something of a personal apocalypse. It meant prison, the dissolution of one's estate. For the least fortunate, it meant torture, starvation, and death. What national bankruptcy would mean at that point in history, nobody knew. There were simply no precedents. Yet, as nations fought greater and bloodier wars, and their debts escalated geometrically, default began to appear unavoidable. Abbé Sieyès first put forward his great scheme for representative government, for instance, primarily as a way of reforming the national finances to fend off the inevitable catastrophe. And when it happened, what would it look like? Would the money become worthless? Would military regimes seize power? Regimes across Europe be likewise forced to default and fall like dominoes, plunging the continent into endless barbarism, darkness, and war? Many were already anticipating the prospect of the terror long before the revolution itself. It's a strange story, because we're used to thinking of the Enlightenment as the dawn of a unique phase of human optimism, born on assumptions that make the advance of science and human knowledge would inevitably make life wiser, safer, and better for everyone, a naive faith said to have peaked in the Fabian socialism of the 1890s, only to be annihilated in the trenches of World War I. In fact, even the Victorians were haunted by the dangers of degeneration and decline. Most of all, Victorians shared the near-universal assumption that capitalism itself would not be around forever. Insurrection seemed imminent. Many Victorian capitalists operated under the sincere belief that they might, at any moment, find themselves hanging from trees. In Chicago, for instance, a friend once took me on a drive down a beautiful old street, full of mansions from the 1870s. The reason he explained that it looked like that was that most of Chicago's rich industrialists of the time were so convinced that the revolution was imminent that they collectively relocated along the road that led to the nearest military base. Almost none of the great theories of capitalism, from anywhere on the political spectrum, from Marx to Weber, to Schumpeter to von Mises, felt that capitalism was likely to be around for more than another generation or two at most. And one could go further. The moment that the fear of imminent social revolution no longer seemed plausible, by the end of World War II, we were immediately presented with the spectre of nuclear holocaust. Then, when that no longer seemed plausible, we discovered global warming. This is not to say that these threats were not and are not real. Yet, it does seem strange that capitalism feels the constant need to imagine, or to actually manufacture, the means of its own imminent extinction. It's in dramatic contrast to the behaviour of the leaders of socialist regimes, from Cuba to Albania, who, when they came to power, immediately began acting as if their system would be around forever, ironically enough, considering the fact that they turned out to be something of a historical blip. Perhaps the reason is because what was true in 1710 is still true. Presented with the prospect of its own eternity, capitalism, or anyway financial capitalism, simply explodes. Because if there's no end to it, there's absolutely no reason not to generate credit, that is, future money, infinitely. Recent events would certainly seem to confirm this. The period leading up to 2009 was one in which many began to believe that capitalism really was going to be around forever. At the very least, no one seemed any longer to be able to imagine an alternative. The immediate effect was a series of increasingly reckless bubbles that brought the whole apparatus crashing down. And that concludes Chapter 11. I'm going to take issue with David Graeber that the whole apparatus has come crashing down. It looks to me very much like it hasn't come crashing down, and there's still lots of ongoing discussion about how it can be prevented from doing so. Where people have expressed their own will forcefully and acted together, countries such as Iceland, where they basically got rid of the bankers and are charging these guys for fraud, we don't hear about. This is off our news radar. And David Graeber has outlined many of the reasons why this apparatus has to come crashing down, but there's still people talking about keeping the debt on the books, or as they like to say, keeping the economy afloat. I'm also going to take issue with David Graeber that nobody had an idea of what could come next. I think a lot of people in the public eye, a lot of the so-called successful, certainly the rich people, couldn't imagine a world where money worked differently. I think a lot of people who were marginalized, sidelined by business as usual, had plenty of ideas of what they would rather do. I was one of these. For the best part of a decade, I've been putting forward a vision of a gift economy. I've heard plenty of people say, oh, it's against nature. People have always been selfish. I'm a firm believer in the Alfie Kohn school on this, which says human nature is a lot more flexible than people give it credit. If sociopathy seems to be normal, I would say it's not inborn, it's not nature, it's nurture. People are nurtured to be selfish by the current money system. So, we now have the soundtrack of a video that I gave in December 2009 to the Chaos Computer Congress in Berlin. Now, this is a super concentrated presentation. It's an hour presentation, which I condensed into the time available, which was 8 minutes. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if you find this rewards re-listening. I've slowed it down slightly, and there is a video which goes with it, which, again, I would recommend to help clarify the points I'm trying to make. I've even got subtitles. If you're a non-native speaker, you might find them helpful. I hope they'll be posted and available on the website by the time you hear this. Our webpage again, unwelcomeguest.net/615. And special thanks to Sven Gukas at the conference, who bent the rules to give me 8 minutes rather than 4 minutes.
If you caught my project from yesterday, then I always had this idea about everybody has their own machine. That's not a server, that's not just sending text, you've actually got data, you're doing operations on your data. So then it occurred to me that there's one special item of data that's really, really important. I'm not talking about who's getting invited to which parties, who's sharing which kind of photos with whom on the social web. I'm talking about the real stuff, okay? That's money. If I'm paying somebody $10, you can say, okay, well, I'm getting a minus 10, he's getting a plus 10. So this is between us, between people. Currently, we have this strange system where there are some trusted third parties, and they are supposed to be in charge of everything. So you don't trust somebody's word, you trust something written with a little bank company. So I thought, okay, can we offer an alternative system of credit that's person to person? This is where it becomes very important to have a strong identity. So I apologize, this talk is another hour talk that's compressed into 4 minutes, or if they're courteous, then a little more. But now imagine you get a call, it's a friend of yours, he says, oh, can you ring me back, please? It's costing me 7 taka per minute, it's 7 units per minute, and you ring him back, it's only going to cost you 2. Would you ring that guy back? Depends on all sorts of things. So the summary is that this is a new form of economics that I have created, and it's about relationships. The normal economics is more about what can I get, and I don't care about anyone else. So I'm saying that there's a concept called sympathy, and if you have that sympathy, that means that you will go without in order to prevent your friend from losing. So what this means in terms of the relationship, you give it a number. That's the indifference value. If you don't know, should I call, should I not? If you're at 0, then you never call them back. If it's your mom, and you know, well, when she dies, I'm going to get all her money anyway, then that's 1, because you're saving your own money. So now we've got a friend of a friend. That's a good friend of yours. So does that have a sympathy value? Well, it does. You do the math, it turns out that it's a product if there's only one path. And you can make these little axioms. That's what I've made. But what we are making is a social web, and it's a network of relationships. Now, you've heard that you get what you measure. So we are measuring altruism. We are measuring how much you care about people. So what we have got here then is not a market, because in a market, I'm looking at the prices. I go to my price comparison site, and okay, maybe I'll think about, do I trust these guys at all to even give me the product? But in a network, everybody is different. People have sympathy for who they're dealing with, and everybody's position is unique. So money has a history. Okay, you're used to saying, how much is it worth to me? You express yourself in numbers. So if there's 2 people working together, you're hoping that they're having a good day, they're helping each other, they both like it. So I'm afraid this is quite a lot to talk. I'm making a criticism of society. People end up doing the things that are bad for both, like we're taking each other to court, and would it be easier if we just didn't bother? Yes, it would, but somebody has an idea, I can get some money off of this guy. So money is forcing people into the lose-lose quadrant that I'm talking is a sign of a sick society. We should be in the healthy society. That's the win-win quadrant. But due to how we score it, then there's the idea that we must compensate any kind of value transfer. I was discussing this yesterday with somebody, and he's saying, you know, for every winner, there must be a loser. And it got as far as, well, okay, so maybe you're having sex with somebody and you're having a good time, you're winning, but you're losing your time. Like, we have got a... We have this idea that it's all about winners and losers, and we can't just accept, okay, life is a gift. Some things you have just got because you are given them, because we are always competing for things. You know, you're selling something, you want to get a little bit more money, you're... Does life have to be like that? Well, if we phrase things in terms of money, yes, it does. Because money says, I'm only getting as much as he's losing. So if I want to get more, I've got to make him lose more. So you basically learn that life is about fighting. You know, from the time you realize that Tom is out to get Jerry. So here's another way that we could do business. We can just honestly state, this is how much it's worth to me. Someone else says, this is how much it's worth to me. And if there's a wide gap, they're both saying, this is a really good thing. I don't want it, I'll give it to him. So there's an incentive there to be honest. That is not about one person wins, the other one loses. So we have a cooperative mentality. We like to cooperate, but we also have to pay the bills. And this is the money system that forces us to compete with one another. So another way we could do it, now this is if you had a sympathy of one with somebody, this is how you would score it. This is the created value. So you'll be ready to maybe you pick up your friend from the station. That costs you a little bit of time, but it's worth a lot to them. And you wouldn't do it for a stranger, perhaps, but you do it to your friend because you're thinking about life through their eyes. You're saying, I'm going to be selfish, not for just me, but for me and the people I care about. Now, it seems to me that is missing in our society. So interpersonal transfers aren't relevant. Is this a way you can run a money system? No, because it does actually matter. If you're giving up all your time to help people, it would be nice to get something back. So what's the solution? Well, we have got two people with two opinions. Let's just say that they can make their own opinion, and I don't have a right to tell somebody else what is their opinion. What have we got? We have got a two-dimensional system. We can do mathematics. It's not so hard. A computer can do it. If we are passing around a little piece of paper or a little piece of metal, it's not possible for me to... We have the zero-sum constraint. We have to be fighting about who gets to have them, but we are not, because we do computers. So I can make a record, you can make a record, okay. We can have an algorithm that says... That's the model. That was an idea I had. This is from about 5 years ago. Then I said, okay, how are we going to program this? We have some very important things that identity has to be protected because we are not talking about just Facebook data. This could be economic data. So let's make a network of XML virtual machines with a strong identity so that you know who it is who's helping you out. And when you are crediting them for what they've done, you're not giving it to some IP hacker there. So that's what I've been working on. Okay, I'll wrap it up with the next slide, which is the practical implementation. This is what it will look like. So it'll look like this. You want something done and say, what do I want? Okay, someone to fix my laptop. I can't fix laptops. Then you're getting offers. These are people who have said, I have an ability to fix a laptop, and the requests. So like Google, there's a lot of pages out there and you want just a few of them. This system can say to put the people towards the top who have helped the most and they have received the least help. These are the people that you should be helping. And it doesn't tell you who to help, but it's based on another assumption that's the reverse of ordinary economics. This assumption is that people like things to be fair. So it's going to show you all the people and it'll say, oh, for the requests, help these people, they have an imbalance. I'm not suggesting a centralized system, I'm suggesting a completely decentralized system, but instead of using money, this will be another way that you can get things done. So it's putting people in touch with other people and it's very reliant on the semantic web and the strong identity. Thank you.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our archive, unlockingguests.net/archive. If you'd like to comment on the show, you can do so by editing its discussion page. If you'd like to be notified of weekly episodes, you can do so by joining our Twitter feed, twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. The theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope this show has given you some perspective on the so-called financial crisis, and I'd love to hear your ideas of more productive and healthy alternatives to the sick money system, which looks to me to be in terminal decline.
By unwelcome travelers, another brave